Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
If you want to get to President Trump, you're going to have to go through me, and you're going to have to go through 75 million Americans just like me. And I'm going to tell you, yep, most of us are card-carrying members of the NRA.
Donald Trump is preparing to surrender today in Miami to become the first president ever to be arraigned on federal charges. As authorities beef up security, we'll look at how Trump and his supporters have responded to the charges with increasingly violent rhetoric about war and insurrection. Then 60 years ago this week, President John F. Kennedy made history by calling for peace with the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War.
Nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish for the world.
And freedom of the press is under attack in Guatemala ahead of this month's general election.
Soy Zamora, and I am the son of imprisoned Guatemalan journalist José Rubén Zamora, who has been facing political persecution from the Yamatei administration simply for denouncing corruption and doing journalism. Because in Guatemala, doing journalism is a crime.
José Rubén Zamora faces 40 years in prison. We'll speak to his son. All that and more coming up. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former President Donald Trump surrendering to federal authorities in Miami, Florida today to face charges for retaining and mishandling classified documents, including top-secret information about U.S. nuclear weapons. In recent days, Trump and many of his supporters have condemned the charges using inflammatory language. Ahead of Trump's arraignment, Miami Police Chief Manny Morales said law enforcement officials are preparing for the possibility of violence by far-right extremists outside Miami's federal courthouse.
Make no mistake about it, we're taking this this event extremely serious. We know that there is a potential of things taking a turn for the worst, but that's not the Miami way.
Trump, who's currently the front runner for the Republican Party's 2024 presidential nominations, planning to fly to his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, after his Florida arraignment to deliver remarks this evening. After headlines, we'll have the latest on the federal indictment against Trump. We'll speak with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, expert on fascism and authoritarianism. In Ukraine, at least 10 people were killed, more than two dozen injured overnight as Russia launched a massive missile attack on the central city of Kryvyi Rih. Victims included residents of a partially collapsed five-story apartment building where rescue crews said people could still be trapped under rubble. Ukraine's military, meanwhile, says it's retaken seven settlements in the Donetsk and Zaporizhia regions in a counteroffensive over the past week. NATO's opened its largest-ever aerial war games in Germany. The military alliance says some 10,000 personnel from 25 countries are taking part in drills involving 250 warplanes. Non-NATO nations Japan and Sweden are participating. The war games opened as French President Emmanuel Macron welcomed German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Polish President Duda to Paris, where the three discussed aid to Ukraine. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg delayed Monday's planned visit with President Joe Biden by a day after Biden had emergency surgery, root canal. On Saturday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made a surprise visit to Kyiv, where he met President Volodymyr Zelensky and addressed Ukraine's parliament. Trudeau pledged $500 million in new military aid and said he would support Ukraine's bid to join NATO during the alliance's July summit in Vilnius, Lithuania.
Canada and many others are very supportive of Ukraine joining NATO when the conditions allow. What that exactly looks like is a conversation that we're continuing to have between now and Vilnius, but I'm very positive about it.
The world's nuclear powers spent nearly $44 billion on weapons of mass destruction last year, or more than $157,000 per minute, with the United States accounting for more nuclear weapons spending than all other nations combined. That's the finding of a new report by the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. The Nobel Peace Prize-winning group found worldwide spending on nuclear weapons rose last year for the third consecutive year. Iran's supreme leader has said he's open to reviving the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from under President Trump in 2018. On Sunday, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said there was nothing wrong with pursuing a revival of the agreement as long as Iran can keep its nuclear infrastructure intact. Khamenei spoke after touring an exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry in Tehran.
Based upon Islamic ideals, we do not want nuclear weapons. But if this wasn't the case, they would not be able to prevent us from doing so, just like they could not prevent our nuclear progress so far.
Human rights groups warn Iran is executing prisoners at its fastest pace in nearly a decade. Over the weekend, at least five prisoners were hanged in Iran. This follows 282 executions carried out in May, nearly double the number recorded during the same time last year. The use of capital punishment in Iran has surged in the months after historic massive protests took to the streets following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody last September. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the UN reports more than 45 people were killed after an attack on a camp for internally displaced communities. The camp, located near a UN peacekeeping site in the Jugu territory, was reportedly infiltrated by fighters of a coalition of armed groups Sunday, who carried out the massacre through the early hours of Monday. The victims were buried in a mass grave. The UN called the attack a serious violation of international humanitarian law. UNESCO says the United States will rejoin the United Nations Cultural and Scientific Agency and will pay more than $600 million in back dues. In 2017, the Trump administration announced it would withdraw the U.S. from UNESCO, citing what it called anti-Israel bias. Israel followed suit immediately after. Both the U.S. and Israel stopped paying member dues in 2011 after Palestine joined UNESCO. In climate news, tens of thousands of dead fish have washed ashore across multiple beaches along the Texas Gulf Coast after they were starved of oxygen due to abnormally warm ocean temperatures. In 2019, the UN warned the climate crisis will increasingly lead to massive die-offs of marine life as warm water holds far less oxygen than colder water. This comes as more than 430 wildfires continue to burn across Canada, with thousands of people in Alberta, British Columbia, and Quebec still under evacuation orders. Quebec's Minister of Public Security said the blazes will likely last all summer, with more air quality alerts likely across the northern U.S. and Canada. Last Wednesday, as thick, dark smoke from Canada's fires blanketed New York City, over 300 people were seen at hospitals due to symptoms of asthma, nearly double the number seen the day before the smoke arrived. The highest rate of emergencies were reported in predominantly low-income Black and Latinx neighborhoods. In Montana, a landmark climate trial led by 16 children and young adults began Monday in the capital, Helena. The lawsuit, which is the first of its kind to go to trial in the U.S., was filed in 2020 by plaintiffs between the ages of 5 and 22. They accused the state of Montana of violating their constitutional rights as it pushed pro-fossil fuel policies that devastated the environment and severely impacted their health. This is Julia Olson, executive director of Our Children's Trust, the nonprofit law firm representing the young plaintiffs.
Children need lawyers, and they need advocates, because our system of law does not prioritize the needs of the youngest among us. And when it comes to climate crisis, human laws are not paying attention to the laws of nature and what scientists say is necessary to protect our children and all future generations.
Earlier this month, a judge cleared the way for a children's climate case against the United States government to begin in a federal court in Oregon after Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts blocked the lawsuit in 2018. J.P. Morgan Chase has agreed to pay $290 million to settle a lawsuit brought by survivors of convicted sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who said the bank ignored warnings about Epstein's sexual abuses for years because he was bringing in wealthy clients. J.P. Morgan Chase still faces a separate lawsuit brought by the U.S. Virgin Islands, where the Attorney General's office said in a statement it'll proceed with its enforcement action to, quote, prevent the bank from assisting and profiting from human trafficking in the future, unquote. And in Pennsylvania, authorities have recovered the body of a tanker truck driver who died after he lost control of his rig and crashed Sunday morning, triggering a fire that collapsed an overpass on Interstate 95 in Philadelphia. The disaster has halted traffic in both directions along the main East Coast artery connecting Florida to Maine. On Monday, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro said officials would have a timeline for its reconstruction once engineers complete a review in the coming days.
With regards to the complete rebuild of I-95 roadway, we expect that to take some number of months.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, authorities in Miami are ramping up security near the federal courthouse where President Donald Trump will surrender today to face charges for retaining and mishandling classified documents, including top secret information about U.S. nuclear weapons. On Friday, the Justice Department unsealed a historic 37-count indictment against Trump, who's running for the White House again. In recent days, Trump and many of his supporters have condemned the charges using inflammatory language. Andy Biggs, a far-right member of Congress from Arizona, wrote on social media, quote, "We've now reached a war phase, an eye for an eye." Louisiana Republican Congressman Clay Higgins wrote a cryptic tweet that many viewed as a call for insurrection. Former Arizona Republican gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake directly threatened violence.
I have a message tonight for Merrick Garland and Jack Smith and Joe Biden and the guys back there in the fake news media. You should listen up as well. This one's for you. If you want to get to President Trump, you're going to have to go through me, and you're going to have to go through 75 million Americans just like me.
Carrie Lake's comments were widely criticized. Ruben Gallego, a Democrat running for Senate in Arizona, responded by saying, quote, "This language isn't just hyperbole. It's dangerous and it threatens the very core of our democracy," unquote. Donald Trump has repeatedly attacked Special Counsel Jack Smith, calling him a deranged lunatic and a thug. On Saturday, Trump spoke in Columbus, Georgia, about what he called the final battle.
Now the Marxist left is once again using the same corrupt DOJ and the same corrupt FBI and the attorney general and the local district attorneys to interfere in our elections at a level that our country and few countries have ever seen before. They're cheating, they're crooked, they're corrupt. These criminals cannot be rewarded. They must be defeated. You have to defeat them.
We're joined now by Ruth Ben-Ghiat, an expert on fascism and authoritarianism, author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. She also publishes the newsletter Lucid on threats to democracy. Professor Ben-Ghiat, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. So tomorrow we'll spend more time after the arraignment talking about all of the counts. But today we're focusing on the threats, on the violent threats. Can you respond?
Yes. Yeah, so this could be seen as a reaction to Trump's indictment and the appearance in Miami. It could be seen by his most fanatic followers as a kind of spark for a second wave of the insurrection. That's certainly the tone of Carrie Lake and Clay Higgins and these other MAGA extremists. But Trump has been preparing this in two ways for many years. First of all, since 2015, he used his rallies. So back, we're talking, you know, 7-8 years now. He used his rallies as radicalization sites. And over, he told his supporters at these rallies that violence was a good way to solve conflict. How many times did you say, oh, you know, in the good old days, we used to be able to punch people and nothing happened? So that discourse of violence, which encouraged January 6th, is part of this. The other is his victim cult. So this won't be a surrender for MAGA extremists. This will be an act of victimization. And all strongmen since Mussolini say they're victims, and this is very compelling to their followers because they feel protective of him, and this is part of their leader cult. And January 6th, of course, was he summoned the faithful to help him in his time of distress. So that narrative is continuing now.
Well, but Professor, how do you account for how few Republicans are standing up to this situation? Of course, Mitt Romney is one of the few, but most are not only lining up behind Trump, but those who are candidates are promising to pardon him if they're elected.
This is because I see the GOP as a scholar of authoritarianism. It is an autocratic party operating inside a democracy, and it is a party in thrall to a cult leader. And Donald Trump, I've been studying cult leaders for, you know, 100 years worth of them. He has all the signs. He is not a conventional politician of either the Democratic or Republican, you know, old school. He is a cult leader. And the GOP has long been, you know, submissive to him. He put them under an authoritarian discipline. And then he made them complicit. And this is what corrupt, violent authoritarians do. They make you part of their crimes. And so the GOP is in damage control mode. And, you know, there's fear, there's fanaticism, and they don't see a way to break away because they're cowards, they've bought into this this war, this battle that he's waging.
And you said that if Trump gets back into power, he'll never leave. What's at stake in this upcoming election? And also, how do you place him in the context of growing right-wing movements in the industrialized West?
Yeah, I said that he would never leave if he gets back in, because he's saying that. The other day when he said to his followers, I'll never leave. On the one hand, he was, this was part of his cult leader, devotional kind of homily to them, where he says, I love you, I'll always be there for you. But it's also telling them, and he always says what he's going to do ahead of time, that if he gets back into power, he will not leave. And he's already talked about, you know, massive purges, and he's got a whole plan that he will pick up and finish the job of wrecking democracy that he couldn't finish before.
Professor Ben-Ghiat, I also want to ask you about the death of Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, which has declared a national day of mourning for Wednesday. The billionaire media tycoon served 4 terms as prime minister of Italy, where he leveraged his unrivaled influence over public opinion in Italy, controlling the newspapers, magazines, 3 major TV channels. Throughout his career, Berlusconi faced multiple charges of money laundering, or at least of corruption, criminal charges, including abuse of office, bribery, paying for sex with an underage girl. Most of the charges ended in dismissals after Berlusconi's government passed laws shielding him from prosecution. But a tax fraud conviction in 2013 barred him from public office for 6 years. Can you talk about what Berlusconi represented?
There's lots of lessons for us today in the Berlusconi era. 2 things I'll mention. Berlusconi set off the whole normalization of the far right. Without him, it would have been a lot slower and harder. In 1994, it was just a brief government, but he brought neo-fascists into the government and made a center-right coalition with the xenophobic Northern League, now they're called the League, and this neo-fascist party. So he broke a taboo. And during his other two governments in the 2000s, the culture of neo-fascism, the culture of fascism itself, which he repeatedly whitewashed, he said to some British journalists, including Boris Johnson was one of them back in 2003, that Mussolini never killed anyone. So what we see today with the revival of neo-fascism and somebody like Giorgia Meloni, the prime minister, who says, oh, I'm a conservative, that whitewashing comes straight out of Berlusconi. And by the way, he gave her her start. The other lesson is prosecution matters. Berlusconi was so able, as you said, he passed, he got the parliament to pass laws. If he was accused of bribery, he got parliament to pass a law saying that bribery wasn't an offense you could be jailed for. And he did this over and over again, or he ran out the clock, very similar to Trump. But finally, 2 years after he left office, he was convicted, and he didn't go to jail because of his age. But it was that conviction and being banned from politics that finally deflated his personality cult and made his party, which he had created, into a minor force in politics. So prosecution sends a message that no one is above the law.
Well, I wanted to ask you about how the media should deal with a figure such as Donald Trump. On the one hand, we have to cover some of the major events that happened related to him. On the other hand, the saturation coverage also provides him more and more free publicity and a platform. What's the proper balance that journalists and the media should exercise, in your view?
Yeah, that's been the question since 2016. However, after January 6, I think that people who didn't see the danger before perhaps see it now. And it's been a little disheartening that some in the media have returned to the default position of treating him as a conventional candidate. Of course, there was the disastrous CNN town hall where, people were not allowed to criticize. They were only supposed to applaud. And that actually recreated an authoritarian plateau. It was perfect for him. You know, other people, they don't retweet not only Trump, but these other MAGA extremists, because that extra engagement is figured into algorithms that promote these people. You can screenshot them. But we do need to cover it, and I speak about it all the time, because we can't close our eyes to this danger. Every society that's had a serious threat to democracy has gone into it with some denial, with some idea that it can't happen here, including Germany in the early 30s, which was one of the most advanced scientific, graphic design, cultural societies in the world. And so it's important to cover it, to not shy away from denouncing it, but also to frame it for what it really is.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, we want to thank you for being with us, expert on fascism and authoritarianism, author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. When we come back, we'll continue looking at strongmen, an authoritarian president in Guatemala, Giamatte, where a publisher, Zerubin Zamora, faces 40 years in jail. But first, 60 years ago, President John F. Kennedy gave a speech about calling for peace between the Soviet Union and the United States. Stay with us.
It was so lonely, heaven just said. Voice of a friend, I could die happy if I started again, started again. It was so
Youth Lagoon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 60 years ago this week, President John F. Kennedy gave a historic speech at the height of the Cold War, calling for peace and a reevaluation of relations with the Soviet Union. Just weeks after Kennedy's speech, Washington and Moscow signed the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. This is part of what President Kennedy said June 10, 1963, during a commencement address at American University in Washington, D.C.
I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age where a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. Today, the expenditure of billions of dollars every year on weapons acquired for the purpose of making sure we never need them is essential to the keeping of peace. But surely the acquisition of such idle stockpiles, which can only destroy and never create, is not the only, much less the most efficient, means of assuring peace. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task. Some say that it is useless to speak of peace or world law or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation, for our attitude is as essential as theirs. And every graduate of this school, every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace, towards the Soviet Union, towards the course of the Cold War, and towards freedom and peace here at home. First, examine our attitude towards peace itself. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. And second, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Soviet Union. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits that